It is absolute carnage and more of a world war-like situation where you see dead bodies everywhere. Those are the words of Tahir Ibn Mansur, a journalist working in New Delhi, the epicenter of the worst COVID-19 outbreak the world has ever seen. It is a war-like situation where you can see dead bodies piled up. Some are rotting with their relatives and family members waiting for hours in the cremation grounds where they are usually cramped for space with furnaces burning around the clock. Article by Rohan Smith for news.com.au, May 5th, 2021. Welcome to the Politics of Pandemics, Episode 26, Pyres in the Parking Lot, Part 1. They were the images that defined the deadly Delta wave for India in early 2021. Hundreds of funeral pyres burning nonstop for days and weeks on end. There were so many of them, the ashes of those lost, choking the air, that Indians were forced to burn their dead in the parking lot outside the traditional areas. And still, dozens more waited on the streets to cremate their dead relatives. There were so many cremations that wood was running out. The dire images of funeral pyres burning were the direct result of the overstressed medical situation India faced as the Delta variant of COVID-19 raced across the country. Hospitals were already forced to treat patients in the corridors and even outside, and still they could not accommodate the massive influx of patients suffering from shortness of breath, pneumonia, fever, and other issues. Many were rejected outright from hospital after hospital and forced to procure medication and supplies themselves. Crowds formed outside oxygen suppliers daily, most left disappointed. Families would watch helplessly as their relatives died, gasping at home, untreated, while they themselves also began to fall sick. It was the worst case scenario for a country of over a billion people. Last we left off in this series, India had blamed the Muslim sect for spreading the first wave of COVID-19 in their country. The truth is that, compared to later waves, the Tablighi Jamaat members had barely spread the coronavirus far beyond their own community, likely because they kept it themselves. As a result, the first wave that originated in their halls back in March of 2020 would be easily dwarfed by later waves of COVID-19, including the Delta wave 1 year later. This episode, we will trace the road that led up to that disaster, what lessons the Indian government failed to take, and the first worrying indications of the pandemic that would grip India and the world for a large portion of 2021. When we first covered India in episode 10, it was purely a focus on the Tablighi Jamaat and the first COVID wave that originated from their gathering in early March 2020. As well as being the first major outbreak of coronavirus in India, it was a vehicle to look at the religious tensions present in the country, as members of the congregation were prosecuted for spreading the virus even a year after the gathering. But in a country of over a billion people, many incredibly religious and where massive religious gatherings of many beliefs are part of daily life, it was only a matter of time before the country would experience more outbreaks, especially as some of these religious congregants managed to flee quarantine and become super spreaders themselves. For instance, in late March of 2020, a 70-year-old man was supposed to self-quarantine after returning from Italy and Germany. He was a Sikh preacher, and after returning home, he attended the Sikh festival of Hola Mohalla, which was 6 days long and attended by 10,000 people. Shortly after, he died. He was found to be positive for the virus. 40,000 people were quarantined as a result. Similar large festivals resulted in occasional super spreader events, and the only reason the Tablighi congregation stood out was the fact that they were Muslim, in a political climate where they were subject to suspicion. To be very clear, religion is far from the only cause of outbreaks in India. In an initial study published by Science in September 2020, researchers tracked 575,071 individuals exposed to 84,965 confirmed cases in two Indian states, Tamil Nadu and Andhra Pradesh. Among the things they found was that children and young adults were significant vectors of infection. In India, the infections and deaths skewed younger than in more affluent countries like the United States. Also, while a majority of the positive cases did not further infect others, quote, super spreading predominated, with 5% of infected individuals accounting for 80% of cases. Let us also not forget that India, like many countries, has a huge amount of informal and transient workers. The World Economic Forum puts the amount of internal migrants at 139 million people. These are all Indians who move from their rural villages to the bustling crowded cities like New Delhi or Bangalore to work as manual laborers or less skilled workers in sectors such as construction, manufacturing, hospitality, transportation, domestic help, and so on. Living and working conditions for these migrants and working class people are bad enough prior to the pandemic, with cramped conditions, low and spotty pay, and injuries related to a lifetime of dangerous manual labor, often permanently depriving them of their ability to work. All of these sectors that relied heavily on migrant and working class employees were shut down during India's long, long lockdowns, leaving hundreds of millions out of work. Unable to find employment, and likely falling sick of COVID-19 themselves, many were left starving. Some were driven onto the streets by their landlords. So, for many, the only recourse is to go back home, however far that is. But transport options were severely limited during the lockdown, with trains suspended, taxis far too pricey, and with too few buses for too many people. With no option left, hundreds of thousands of them began to walk, literally, for hundreds of miles back to their villages. The scenes were like something out of an apocalypse. Thousands of people, men, women, old, young, even children, walking along mostly barren roads. Many walked with only sandals, carrying their meager belongings on their heads or their children on their shoulders. They would do so for days. If they were lucky, kind strangers or charities would offer them food or water, but many would just go hungry, and some would never make it home. Stories emerged of these caravans of people being beaten by state police as they crossed borders or sacred bridges. Thousands would be killed in auto accidents as they walk along highways. The desperate migrants often walked in large groups for safety, but that also meant that the waves of people leaving the COVID-infested cities would themselves become vectors of infection, spreading the disease amongst themselves and in their villages when they arrived. For many, it would be the last journey they ever took. Whatever help that the Indian government could offer for the suffering migrants and for all Indians seemed to come too little and too late. The extended lockdown, the mass quarantine of tens of thousands of people, and trying to get everyone to stay indoors while making sure they don't starve is a Herculean task for all countries, let alone one with 1.3 billion people. For India, the 2020 lockdown, without any economic mitigation, changed the Indian working class far more than COVID cases did. Quoting now from an article by Rahul Ahoti for the University of Pennsylvania, quote, 100 million workers lost jobs during the nationwide lockdown between April and May 2020. The repercussions of the crisis were so severe that Even when the economy had mostly opened up by the end of 2020, the country saw only partial recovery in labor markets and household incomes, as about 15 million workers continued to remain out of work. Seasonally adjusted per capita incomes in October 2020 were 16% below their levels in February 2020. Income inequality skyrocketed during this pandemic, with 230 million people more earning below the minimum wage as a result of the lockdowns. Even those that kept their jobs or got employment again following reopening suffered a loss of income. This is probably why India reopened in early June of 2020. Branding it Unlock 1.0, the government mandated everything went back to relative normality, with mostly just guidelines on how to prevent coronavirus. Typical things like hand sanitizer and social distancing. India did this despite the number of cases still going up, hitting 10,000 cases a day in June. That increase would keep going on for months. In September 2020, that first wave of COVID-19 peaked at 93,000 cases a day. It would seem like the break they needed after a tough year. Maybe the reduction was due to herd immunity, with so many Indians already infected officially, and the unofficial number likely far higher. Maybe the country was now safe from coronavirus. And with the country reopened again, Indians were hoping and praying that the worst of the pandemic had passed. They were sadly dead wrong. The game of evolution is a game of chance, and with each new replication comes an infinitely tiny probability of a mutation happening. When the replication process doesn't produce a perfect copy of its parents. The vast majority of mutations in viruses and otherwise are benign, and some are damaging and even fatal. But every now and then, a mutation comes along that allows the virus to adapt to its surroundings better and survive in the harsh environment of our bodies. These mutations are passed on to its descendants, and those descendants outcompete the other members of their species. They spread easier, faster, while less successful mutations die out or get relegated to the fringes. Occasionally, these mutations become really successful. This is how we got COVID-19, and this is how we got the Delta variant, or B.1.617, as per its scientific designation. The Delta variant, as it was named in May 2021, dominated the pandemic during that time, immediately superseding all other variants in the majority of countries. Infections caused by the variant tended to be more severe than previous variants, due to the virus seemingly causing a higher viral load, and also because the infectivity period is much longer. This higher load also leads infected people to spread the virus to more people. This higher infectivity and severity forced a sea change in COVID strategy for many countries, as the infrastructure and measures set to combat the original wave of COVID became overwhelmed by its new, deadlier variant. We saw something like this happen when the Gamma variant devastated Manaus, Brazil on New Year's Day in 2021. The Delta variant would wreak similar havoc in many other places in the world, and it likely started in India somewhere, or at least it was first identified as such in late 2020. Amravati is a small city of about 600,000 people located in the middle of India, in the state of Maharashtra. For India, that is small, and relatively rural as well, being about 400 miles from the state capital of Mumbai. While Mumbai, with its metro population of over 20 million, suffered significant flare-ups of COVID-19 over 2020, Amravati's distance from major population centers, as well as its spread-out population density, kept them relatively safe from COVID-19. And when the first wave of COVID in India started to peter out in late 2020, it seemed like Amravati would escape the worst of the pandemic. But then cases started to show up there at a rate that would dwarf the rate of cases in Mumbai. Quoting Sahil Joshi of India Today on February 23, 2021, quote, in September 2020, when Maharashtra and Mumbai reached their peaks in daily COVID-19 cases, recording more than 35,000 and 2,500 cases a day respectively, the far-flung district of Amravati was hardly recording 100 cases daily. But today, when Maharashtra appears to be staring at a second COVID-19 wave, the number of cases recorded daily in Mumbai and Amravati are nearly the same. With 5,406 active cases, Amravati ranks second in the list of districts with the highest number of active COVID-19 cases in Maharashtra. Only Mumbai, with 6,850 active cases, is ahead of it. Mumbai is, of course, many times larger than Amravati. The same article claims half of the people tested for the virus in that small town would be tested positive. At first, it seemed like local factors were at play. Lethargy over the first lockdown caused people to be lax. There was also a change in weather, which some pointed to as the cause of the outbreak. But soon, it became clear something was very different. Bloomberg interviewed Ravi Bhushan, a local doctor who quickly sensed something was wrong. Quote, as January drew to a close, Bhushan was already sensing that the city of more than 600,000 residents was becoming a petri dish for a form of COVID-19 his team hadn't treated before. Earlier, patients' symptoms improved in under 2 weeks, but now they were battling the virus for almost 20 to 25 days, he said. It was a nightmarish situation. But while Amravati was going through hell, the first indications of what would turn out to be the most devastating wave of the COVID-19 pandemic in India was largely ignored by the country at large. Nationally, the number of cases was actually going down. The National Health Minister declared in January 2021 that the pandemic had been contained, and cities like Mumbai reopened their offices and transport systems. Rocked by the trauma that the first lockdown had imposed upon an unprepared population, many became lax. Social distancing, masking, and sanitary measures became intermittent. And any advice regarding illness mitigation was summarily ignored. And while it was tempting to blame the people of India, truth is, they were just doing what their political and religious leaders were doing as well, gathering massive rallies and festivals with little regard for the ongoing pandemic. If there is a record for the largest gathering of people in the world, the Kumbh Mela festival on the banks of the Ganges River is right up there. In 2019, over 200 million devout Hindus attended the festival during one of the most important years in the 12-year cycle of this festival. 50 million people attended its most important day. The festival can last between 1 to 3 months, as the cities designated as gathering points come alive with processions, rituals, and feasts. Hindus from all over the world would come here, a celebration of their faith and the culture that they celebrate. For the devout, it all culminates in a ritual bath in the river Ganges, washing their sins away with millions of others. In the age of President Narendra Modi and his Hindu nationalist BJP, the Kumbh Mela has taken on a new significance. The 2021 edition of the massive festival was to be held at the city of Haridwar, with 9 million attending. Holding such a festival with no restrictions and only the barest of measures to combat the pandemic would be the signal to the world that India was back to normal once again. Even as cases began to climb and stories came out of this new more devastating, more severe strain of COVID-19 impacting communities, officials refused to cancel the event. Shuttering it would be a huge blow to the political message of the government that everything was fine. But also it would upset the Hindu nationalists that were the backbone of the BJP. To be very clear, the demand that the festival stay open did not come from Modi or any single party official as far as I can tell. Rather, it seemed like the political and logistic cost of shuttering or controlling such an important religious gathering would simply be too high. And simply speaking, it became a difficult proposition politically and practically to stop pilgrims from descending to Haridwar. Take for instance Trivendra Singh Rawat, the former chief minister of the state Haridwar sits in Uttarakhand. He told the BBC that he planned for the event to be a, quote, limited symbolic event, saying, the festival attracts people from not just India, but other countries too. I was worried that healthy people would visit Haridwar and take the infection back with them everywhere. But just days before the festival, Trivendra was replaced by Triat Singh Rawat, who famously said that with, quote, the blessings of Ma Ganga, the river goddess, in the flow, there would be no corona. While Trivendra's resignation did not seem to be directly related to the festival, as he had been under pressure over his mismanagement of the state over other disasters as well as his other inane comments unrelated to COVID, if Trivendra wanted to be cautious about Kumbh, any sentiment of that went away with his leaving. Pilgrims did not need a negative test to attend and were just advised to follow social distancing measures, impossible in a festival of 9 million people. Many pilgrims began to arrive weeks before the official event. The same BBC article highlights one priest, 80-year-old Mahan Shankar Das, arriving in Haridwar on March 15, 2 weeks before the official start of the festival. There he stayed until April 4th, the fourth day of the 15-day celebrations, when he started testing positive for the virus. Mahan Das was advised to quarantine in a tent, but instead, he packed his bags and boarded a train. Traveling 1,000 kilometers to Varanasi, his son met him at the station where they took a taxi and another 20 kilometers to his village. He would quarantine at home, and Mahan Das insists he did not spread the illness to anyone, but his son and many others fell sick after. According to his son, 13 have died in their villages in the past 2 weeks. These cases may not be linked directly to this old preacher, but there were hundreds of thousands of other people, like Mahan Das, who got the virus and brought it back home to their villages and states, all over the Indian subcontinent. Pilgrims returning from the weeks-long festival began to show up with COVID symptoms. Amongst them, the former king of Nepal, Jayanendra Shah, and his wife, who were found positive after returning to Nepal. The deposed last king of Nepal was seen interacting with pilgrims while maskless. Bollywood composer Sharvan Rathod died not long after returning as well. Dozens of ordinary people were found to be positive upon returning home to their respective states. Many were quarantined at the time, but the authorities were not able to catch everyone. Many, many more was likely never detected if no tests were carried out, returning to their villages or homes without anyone being the wiser. This is where decentralization of pandemic measures at this time needs to be addressed. Absent a national COVID strategy at this time, states and cities were adopting distinct COVID strategies in response to the severity of the outbreaks in their own respective areas. This allows state and local governments to be flexible in their response, but it also means that quarantining, enforcement, and reporting of corona cases vary widely from state to state. Simply speaking, some were better at controlling the outbreaks than others, as well as reporting cases and outbreaks. Some people who were able to walk on the trains with COVID symptoms on one state were quarantined upon arrival at another. We don't really know how many people in total brought the virus home from attending the Kumbhela. Neither do we know how many of the increasing number of sick people got the virus from Haridwar, directly or otherwise. Over 1,000 people were tested positive at the event, but the actual number is almost certainly far higher. Contact tracing was another one of those things that requires extensive coordination and management from the government, and becomes nigh impossible when gatherings the size of Kumbhela were involved. Also, the Kumbhela was far from the only large gathering happening in India in early 2021, though it was the largest. These gatherings include the never-ending political rallies happening across the city. It seems like in a country of 1.3 billion people, there's always some local election happening somewhere. Virtual political rallies are a thing, but nothing beats the communal nature of an in-person rally, which can take on an almost celebratory communal atmosphere as people of a similar political bent gather in their hundreds or thousands or more to support their candidate. And it is something that all parties from both sides of the political aisle are guilty of. Once the explosions of cases following the Kumbhela became obvious, attention fell onto the Uttarakhand state government. Why didn't they cancel or limit the gathering, and why aren't they canceling the upcoming religious gatherings either? Coming up in late April was a Char Dham Yatra, a multi-day pilgrimage to some far-flung temples located in the Himalayas that would almost certainly spread COVID-19 to the communities living in those remote areas. The Indian High Court actually pulled up the state government over this matter, and the Uttarakhand government simply gave the stock answer that, quote, "It is in the process of framing rules and procedures to ensure smooth conduct of the Char Dham Yatra." But the next day, the pilgrimage was suspended. But by the end of the Kumbhela festival, COVID-19 cases were already spiraling out of control in many states. On April 5th, 2021, India recorded 100,000 cases for the first time, and by early May, over 400,000 confirmed cases were recorded in a single day. April 2021 was when the grim images of crowded funeral pyres began to trickle out of Indian cities. Hindus cremate their dead in piles of wood as they believe the body must be destroyed in order for the soul to reincarnate. And in overhead shots during this time, you can still see several dozens of them burning at one time in the crematorium grounds, the ashes of the dead choking the air. It is not uncommon to see piles of ashes in the parking lot, crowded out by lack of space in the crematoriums themselves. Their grieving relatives, many sick themselves, crying beside the bodies, while outside, even more wait with the bodies of their loved ones. Some families even fought for space, getting into physical altercations. Funeral workers were having to work around the clock, day and night, to handle the huge influx of dead. Many reported several times more bodies than they normally see in a day, causing COVID protocols to become lax. Quoting Shunti, a crematorium head in Delhi, speaking to CNN in late April 2021, quote, "We have cremated 55 bodies in the last 5 hours. It will be 100 by the end of the day," he said on Wednesday morning. "I'm tired, but this is not the time to get tired. This is the time to work for the nation, for humanity, and save lives." These numbers do not seem to match official government case and death numbers for COVID, though. Quoting Reuters, India Today reported two crematoriums in Bhopal, the capital of the central state of Madhya Pradesh. 187 bodies were cremated following COVID protocols in 4 days this month, while the official COVID death toll stood at 5. Last week, Sandesh, A Gujarati newspaper counted 63 bodies, leaving a single COVID-only hospital for burial in the state's largest city, Ahmedabad, on a day where government data showed only 20 coronavirus deaths. Fewer than a quarter of deaths in India are medically certified, particularly in rural areas, meaning the true COVID death rate in many of India's 24 other states may never be known. One look at the hospitals and you can see why. Overwhelmed and understaffed, hospitals can barely handle the patients they have as it is. The sick lie on the ground, their own family members forced to assist in caring for them as the doctors and nurses run ragged through the floor. There is no COVID protocol here. Hospitals are short of everything. PPE, oxygen, manpower. The crowded wards became vectors of infection themselves. Many simply never make it to the hospital. Those that try are rejected due to the lack of space anyway, so they try to ride out the virus at home. For those living in rural areas, it gets worse due to the lack of medical access, even in the best of times. And for the numerous Indians living below the poverty line, medical care and sometimes even tests are just out of their reach. And speaking of tests, there is ample evidence that India just isn't testing enough to account for most of their cases. Data around this time suggests that India is only testing 5 people for every confirmed case. The ideal threshold should be closer to 20. There is also simply no impetus for people to get tested. Quoting Dr. Prabhat Jha of the University of Toronto, quote, "There are still lots of people who are not getting tested. Entire houses are infected. If one person gets tested in the house and reports they're positive, and everyone else in the house starts having symptoms, it's obvious they have COVID. So why get tested?" Dr. Jha estimates that the actual number of cases could be 10 times the reported number of 400,000 cases a day. The speed and severity of the second wave in India, driven by the deadlier Delta variant, caught everyone by surprise. Or did it? There was ample warning from health experts that such a wave could happen again, and that large gatherings like the religious festivals would be a perfect source for a new outbreak. But state and federal officials, spooked by the disastrous handling of the first lockdown and the impact it had on its people, were reluctant to shut down again, and thought they could ride out whatever happens next. As a result, between just March 1st and June 11, 2021, 100,000 deaths due to COVID have been recorded, averaging over 2,000 a day. The actual number is almost certainly much higher. So where was the government in all this? How are they handling the lack of supplies and explosions in cases? And after the disastrous way that the government handled the first wave, did they take any lessons from 2020? Not to mention, India manufactures their own vaccines and has had a vaccine program in place since January. The people of India, to their credit, have one of the lowest vaccination hesitancy rates in the world. So why weren't the vast majority of people vaccinated even as case numbers reach 400,000 a day? We'll be taking a look at these and more in part 2 of this mini-series on India's Delta disaster. Sources for this episode can be found in the episode description. For correspondence and corrections, please message me on Twitter at PolyPandemicPod. I also have a Patreon now, which you can help support the show at PolyPandemicPod. No member rewards planned yet, but I will thank you at the end of the show if you do contribute. Regardless, I would like to hear from you, your story of dealing with this pandemic or any disease, and if you have any suggestions or future topics you'd like me to look into. I apologize once again for any mistakes, truncations, and pronunciation errors I have made in the preceding episode. And finally, get boosted, wash your hands, and always be critical of any information you consume. with Lumi's podcast. Thank you for listening.